Jackson in this appeal, and I will be arguing the issue of the severance, and I will also be arguing some sentencing issues towards the end of the arguments. I have 10 minutes for this. I'd like to reserve three if the court's questions permit that.
Do the best you can.
Just check guilty, guilty, guilty. Have you ever heard of anything like that before in the way of a defense counsel's argument at closing? Now, I recognize that the trend in modern jurisprudence in federal courts is that severance basically is disfavored these days. But having said that, it's certainly appropriate in some extraordinary cases, and we suggest to you this is such an extraordinary case. It is not easily pigeonholed, as we said, and that's why we made an argument to you that it's really more of an amalgam between antagonistic defenses in the sense that Mr. Franklin's counsel was basically doing the government's work for it with respect to many, many elements and charges of this, but also a Bruton issue because in reality, what Mr. Tuminelli was doing was making admissions to the jury. They were factual admissions. They were legal admissions as well, and the defendants really had no opportunity to rebut or reply to that. In considering this, I think maybe it would be helpful for me to start by talking just a little bit about, in the real world, how we defend, we, meaning defense attorneys, defend these sort of broad-based conspiracy cases. Because they're not single identifiable incidents, it's very difficult to mount an misidentification defense or an alibi defense or a discrete self-defense. Generally speaking, because of the way the sentencing works, and we'll clearly talk about that later, because you have to be concerned about the conspiracy as well as the individual counts, generally speaking, what defense attorneys try to do in these circumstances is have a broad-based attack on the government's case in any way that they can. The investigation was incomplete, it was inappropriate, it was insufficient, the witnesses are mistaken or they're lying, the cooperating witnesses, you know, have a lot that causes them to be biased and to not testify truthfully. In many cases, nothing that the cooperating witnesses can say is corroborated about what they claim occurred in the neighborhood and so forth. And it is because it is a broad-based attack that tries to attack the government's case in many different ways. That's why when you have someone standing up on behalf of one of the defendants, in this case the lead defendant, and saying that his client is guilty, not just conceding the facts, although that we suggest would be enough, but actually saying the client is guilty of a number of these charges, that is essentially conceding the elements of the offense. It is saying the government has proven the elements of the offense as to his client. What does that leave? The government correctly points out that leaves perhaps one remaining defense, and that is that the government somehow has not proven the question of identity as to a particular offense or a particular charge.
Our participation, it's conspiracy theory, and at least part of the case is, so at least on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
But even there, you see, even there, Mr. Tuminelli, in addition to talking about guilt of particular charges, although he claims that he's arguing that Franklin is not guilty of the conspiracy, he nonetheless admits that there are many drug activity agreements. He admits that his client participated in a series of acts. In other words, that he is conceding many of the elements of conspiracy. Again, frankly, leaving really the issue of identity and robbing the defense of the opportunity to attack, not robbing us of the opportunity, that's the wrong statement, but essentially hindering us, putting handcuffs on the defendant, because here is the lead defendant's lawyer getting up and making these assertions that the government has essentially proven significant elements, and in some cases, all of the elements of its offenses. So for that reason,
are you arguing in part that as a result of the opening statement and closing statement, that certain concessions that were made by the defendants, in other words, the decisions not to attack certain things, was affected? I understand your general argument.
Yes. It's true.
Whereas a defendant says, well, I'm just not even going to put on any evidence on that particular count.
There are two of these counts involving Mr. Blackson, who I represent, who we agree this issue does not affect. Those were the two vehicle stops that occurred. They involved the possession with an intent to distribute ecstasy. And we acknowledge that we didn't have, we had some Fourth Amendment defenses to that were rejected. We're not raising them in this appeal. But with respect to what happened on 18th and M, yes, our view is that when someone like Franklin's attorney gets up and makes the admissions that he makes, saying that it is with the approval of his client, saying indeed at one point that it is based on information from his client, what his client told him, which strikes me as bizarre in itself for a defense attorney to assert, but that's what's happening, and the jury's hearing that. How can the jury not have considered that as a concession?
So we would have to hold, under your view, that notwithstanding Zafiro and the Supreme Court's basic statement that if the trial court makes appropriate gives the jury appropriate instructions, that would mitigate any prejudice.
Well, if suppose that.
In other words, that's why I was asking the question about.
Right.
You know, does the concession or admission of guilt so adversely affect the defendant's ability to defend that the basic premise underlying Zafiro disappears?
I do believe it does because of the unique aspect of this essentially being admissions, essentially being a Bruton-type situation. And Bruton, you know, had to do with out-of-court statements. But essentially, the jury cannot disregard that and just put that out of their mind and say, well, okay, you know, we're going to pretend we didn't hear that, or we're going to pretend that carries no weight with us. It clearly carries weight with us. The issue that I've tried to address in the reply brief, one, was why the jury had to essentially, as human beings, consider what Franklin's attorney admitted, and why I also tried to argue why that impacted the other defendants as well. I see I have but a few minutes. Perhaps if I could retain those and have a chance to speak to you again.
We'll see you on rebuttal. Assuming counsel says something you need to rebut.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stratton Strand on behalf of the government. If I could respond first factually and then legally. Mr. Tuminelli made one specific type of concession. That was he conceded the substantive distribution counts and the communications facilities counts generally. As soon as he did so, he...
And the gun.
The non-conspiracy counts, he made general concessions as to those. He immediately advised the jury, we do not represent Mr. Wilson, Mr. Robinson, Mr. Simmons, or Mr. Blackson, so anything that I say to you, and in particular the fact that we just admitted that he was a PCP and ecstasy dealer, does not apply to these other four men.
Well, what's your answer to my last question? In other words, I know the D.C. Court of Appeals has adopted the notion of, you know, it's impossible for the jury to put this out of its minds. It's the elephant in the room. This circuit hasn't adopted that approach yet. And I haven't seen it in the Supreme Court cases other than where the Supreme Court says, you know, it's impossible for the jury to do its job in a fair manner.
Zafiro forecloses appellant's argument. In Zafiro, there were four defendants who were tried jointly for a drug conspiracy, and two of the defendants' lawyers directly implicated the other two co-defendants and
That's
said...
That's where there was a circle, wasn't it?
Yes.
I didn't do it, he did it.
I didn't do it, he did it. Two of them went against each other.
Right.
At a circular firing squad.
Right.
And the Supreme Court said... There's no suggestion that the Supreme Court considered that a Bruton problem. In fact, the Supreme Court specifically held that instructions saying that arguments of counsel are not evidence, in addition to instructions from the court that you're to consider each defendant's guilt independently of the others, were sufficient to cure any possibility of prejudice. If there had been a Bruton problem in defense counsel directly accusing another defendant, the court couldn't possibly have reached the holding that it reached in Zafiro. So Zafiro forecloses any argument that this is some kind of Bruton denial of a specific trial right issue. There's no possibility of prejudice here. These were not mutually antagonistic defenses.
Let me just ask you, I thought the specific trial right was more in terms of, you know, evidence that in a joint trial would come in that wouldn't be admissible in a separate trial, things like that.
That's one of the types, yes, Your Honor. And Bruton is another of the types of specific trial rights. But there's no claim here that evidence came in that would not have been otherwise admissible. These were not mutually antagonistic defenses. Mr. Tumminelli conceded guilt as to substantive distribution counts, but strenuously contested the conspiracy counts. This was the approach that all the defendants took.
The participation defense was, we didn't participate in the conspiracy, participation is on the table. It was not affected.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. Each defendant's guilt was individually proved by substantial evidence, which we've cited in our brief. The court gave the exact same four instructions that the Supreme Court held in Zafiro were sufficient to cure any possibility of prejudice. And finally, as in Gilliam, from this circuit that Judge Rogers either wrote or was on the panel for, just as in Gilliam, the jury obviously was able to distinguish among the defendants here, despite Mr. Tumminelli's concessions. They found Mr. Simmons was not involved in the crack cocaine aspect of the conspiracy. That's at JA 803-804. And they found that Mr. Robinson was not guilty of count 81, the quid ecstasy. So obviously the jury was not simply amalgamating the evidence to find everyone guilty because it believed Franklin was guilty. For all those reasons, we believe there was no abuse of discretion in the motion to sever. Denying the motion to sever.
Thank you, counsel. You all want to have the rebuttals now or put them all at the end? I guess go ahead and do it now.
I think we're doing it that way, Your Honor, because we have a sealed matter at the very end in any event. Let me just say that I think let me talk about the Zafiro and why we did not place all of our eggs in the Zafiro basket. Because Zafiro was something remarkably different than what we have here, because it was, as the Chief Judge says, a circular firing squad. Under those circumstances, the jury can discredit, you know, the statements of one counsel because he's obviously acting in the interest of his client against the interest of the others. But that can be disputed because they're all contradicting each other. Here, it was not a situation where Franklin's lawyer said, Blackson did it, Simmons did it, Wilson did it. His lawyer got up and said, we did it. We committed these crimes. We are guilty of these crimes. Their evidence is credible.
The we part of that was not admitted.
That's true, Your Honor. That's true. I stand corrected. But he is talking about participating in drug activity agreements. He's agreeing that the government's witnesses are credible, which is another thing that is different than what's happening with the circular firing squad argument. Yes, we don't win. If Franklin had testified and gotten up and said those things in an effort to gain his credibility with respect to some of the other counts, then you're right. We would be left with Zafiro, and we would probably lose if we had had a chance to cross-examine Franklin about the admissions that his lawyer made in his behalf.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. I'm David Smith, and I represent William Simmons in this appeal. I'm going to argue three issues and reserve 1 minute for rebuttal time on each issue. And the first issue that in order is the vouching issue. I was rereading my brief this morning, and I realized that there's a point here that I should have made that I didn't. And that is that this error with regard to vouching may well have affected the jury's consideration of the numerous other cooperating witnesses in the case. After all, most of the government's witnesses were cooperators who were in the same situation as Roberta Moore. They had pled guilty, or they were, most of them had pled guilty and were reliant on the government for getting a reduction in their time. So it would be logical for the jury to believe that since the judge approved of the question to Ms. Moore, that is, what would the judge do if she thought you were lying?
Sure that I see that as a vouching question. It's a motive question. If you've made a deal, your exposure to perjury is your motive for telling the truth, or part of your motive for telling the truth. And this was on, wasn't this on redirect in the Moore case?
Yeah, I believe it was on redirect.
Yeah, so motive was on the table by that time, given the cross, and I'm not sure that I see what's wrong with the question.
Well, obviously the case law suggests that it's wrong.
I didn't find a case that was that squarely on point, counsel.
Really?
I read your brief and the government's brief, but, and I didn't find a case that was that squarely on point.
The Brown case from this court from last year seems to be on point.
Is that the I Believe case?
Excuse me?
Is that the I Believe case?
Yeah.
Xavier Brown?
I don't know the person's first name.
That's the one where the prosecutor directly said, I believe, isn't it?
Right, and the court found that the error was plain.
That's not the same as this case. The court found plain error on some different facts. That doesn't mean the court could find plain error on these facts.
I understand, Your Honor.
I didn't find a case that was that squarely on point.
Well, our argument is that this is worse because it puts the court's puts the judicial imprimatur on the witness's testimony rather than the prosecutor herself vouching for the witness's credibility. And we cited a string of cases saying that this is worse.
You had actually the imprimatur, but all you have here is a recitation that I can go to jail if I lie.
But how is the judge to know that the person is lying? Because it suggests that the judge, either herself or through the prosecutor's good offices, will monitor the credibility of this witness, and that's just impossible.
The suggestion doesn't immediately leap to my mind when I hear that exchange.
It doesn't? Well,
if we have a perjury statute, then that presumes, and contempt of court even, that presumes that there are ways of establishing the truth of a witness's testimony or the falsity.
Well, it would be one thing if the prosecutor carefully said, asked the witness, do you understand that you can be prosecuted for perjury? That I think that would be a legitimate question, and that you can be punished for perjury. But that's not the question here. The question is, what would the judge do if she thought you were lying? She thought you were lying. Not she found as beyond a reasonable doubt that you were lying, but she thought you were lying. And that certainly suggests that the judge has some kind of capacity to monitor this witness's credibility and veracity.
Where does it say she... I don't think that's the way the question was phrased.
I'll read you the exact question, Your Honor.
I don't think it said anything about what the judge thought. Just to be precise about this, I thought it was, what do you think she'd do if you lied?
What would you think she'd do if you lied?
Right. You were saying.
Oh, okay. If you thought. Okay.
If she thought you lied.
Okay. Well, I stand corrected.
You were placing emphasis on the she thought, then.
But
not in the question.
If you lied, but the question is not if you were found guilty of perjury. The question is if you lied. So somehow the judge and the prosecutor have the ability to determine to know whether the person is whether the witness is lying. That does suggest that the court and the prosecutor are acting in some sort of guardian fashion to make sure that to assure that this witness will not lie. And it's particularly funny because this witness has no credibility.
Thank you. Your time is up unless my colleagues have further questions.
Thank you.
We'll hear the government on this issue, and then we'll see you again on
the next issue. Thank you.
Stratton Strand on behalf of the government. The trial court did not plainly err in overruling this objection. As Your Honor's question suggests, the defense had put on the table the Roberta Moore's motives for testifying, and this was proper rejoinder to what Roberta Moore's state of mind was. And in any event, just as in Xavier Brown, there's no possibility that this could have affected the outcome of the case or seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or reputation of the proceedings. Moore was an ancillary witness. The jury didn't have to assign any weight to her testimony to find Mr. Simmons guilty. Moore was one of five witnesses who testified that William Simmons was Mr. Franklin's runner. Monica Bell testified that William Simmons often delivered dippers, and William Simmons' runner activities were documented on video and audio tape. The question was a single isolated occurrence in the midst of a very long trial, and the trial court gave a curative instruction. For all those reasons, we...
Thank you, counsel. All right. Mr. Smith, on the next issue.
I'm sure there'll be more about this later, Your Honor, but, you know, I've made a big point about the prosecutor's argument that the evidence against Simmons was somehow overwhelming, lumping him together with the other defendants. I mean, if there was ever a case where the evidence was not overwhelming, it's this case. And I just heard the government say, well, you know, he's shown on video and audio tape, and there's plenty of evidence against him, so this had to be harmless error, and that's far from the case. You know, in the briefs, we go into great detail as to what the videos show, and they show him engaging in one handoff on behalf of Franklin. One handoff in this entire conspiracy.
You were not trial counsel, were you, or were you?
Excuse me?
Were you trial counsel?
No, I was not, Your Honor.
It seemed to me that the question itself was objectionable. The objection came only after the answer was given, if I remember the record correctly, and this was an awfully open-ended question. What do you know about his destructive lifestyle?
Well, I'm not arguing that one yet, but it was a well.
What are you arguing?
He's on rebuttal.
I'm on rebuttal of the first one, but it wasn't.
The evidence argument you were making seemed to apply to both issues, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor. I might as well launch into the second one.
Move into the next issue, then. I thought we were in the next issue. I'm sorry for any confusion that I may have caused. Give him back a minute.
Well, it is an awfully open-ended question, and it makes me quite suspicious that I hate to suggest this, but that the prosecutor knew what the answer was going to be to this question, because it's a very strange question to ask. What do you know about this witness's lifestyle of destruction, the defendant's lifestyle of destruction? It sort of invited, as Your Honor suggests, it invited an answer such as the answer that was given, which one wonders why was that question even asked, when we have something called Rule 404B, which requires pretrial notice of other crimes evidence. And there was no notice whatsoever here, pretrial or during the trial. But in any event, I don't remember, frankly, whether the objection came before the answer or after the answer, but I don't believe that...
It was preserved, I guess.
It was certainly preserved. The government doesn't argue.
Correctly, the objection didn't come in until the answer was given, and it seemed to me the trial court would have had a much better chance to pass on the impropriety had counsel made a timely objection.
I think that would probably, I'd agree with that, but it doesn't really matter legally.
It was given, it's really a hard call in a trial court's discretion as to whether to emphasize that one little piece of answer by giving a curative instruction or just say, well, leave that alone and move on. Either way the trial court handled it, at that point the defense is going to be up here telling us it was the wrong way, or if the objection had been made at the question, it could have been handled.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I mean, as you know from your own experience, it's very difficult to if we don't know how fast the answer was given here after the question. Sometimes you really don't have time to make an objection before the answer is given. But even assuming he...
Long, I mean, you can talk over the witness when you're objecting, and just like I just talked over this, you there. It's not rude either time. It's necessitated that if you're at that defense table and a question like this is asked, I would think I would have been objecting as quickly as the witness would have been answering, certainly before they got a whole answer out.
But the point here is that even though trial counsel's performance may not have been perfect, he preserved the issue. The government doesn't dispute that, and Your Honor seems to agree with that he
when
preserved the issue.
When we're looking at the possible prejudice or whether it's reversible to have had this in the record, it does come out very differently than if the court had had a chance to have cured it.
Well, the court had plenty of chance after it came out to strike it, but the court didn't even stop to hear argument on this point.
Said there shouldn't be further reference to the killing aspect of the statement, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
It was agreed, right, that there had been a lifestyle of destruction involving drugs.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
The key to this statement, the key problem from your perspective, is the reference to the killing.
Killing and robbing, and a history of killing.
The district judge said there should not be further references to that.
By implication, yes, Your Honor. But the fact is she specifically refused to strike it. And so the jury was allowed to consider that extremely prejudicial testimony, and not only prejudicial, but even more outrageously, without any basis in fact. The government has to this day never suggested that there was any basis for that testimony. That is, that there was any history of robbing and killing. So for this witness to get away with injecting that into a case, what is the jury to think? I mean, here's a person who appears
to be... The jury, obviously, there was a murder count, right?
Correct, which he was acquitted on.
Right.
So
it suggests the jury didn't just say, oh,
that's,
there's a prior killing, therefore...
I understand, Your Honor, and that's what the government argues on the issue of prejudice. But the fact is that the evidence on the Lurk murder was quite weak, and that really explains the acquittal. It does not mean that the jury didn't... How could the jury fail to consider a history of robbing and killing,
well,
presumably?
One slight reference, immediate reference from a pretty flaky witness. That I think the jury, assuming they considered it, may not have given a whole lot of weight to that, counsel.
If you are on the jury, Your Honor, I mean, and you're told, and the judge approves of a witness's statement.
The judge approves is a pretty strong statement.
Well, she didn't strike it.
Don't do that anymore.
It wasn't that strong. She said,
if she had ordered it stricken, you'd have been up here arguing that all that did was emphasize it.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
Well, I have faith in you.
The fact that she did not strike it, and that is extremely prejudicial, especially when there's so little evidence against my client. Again, where you also make a cumulative error argument, there's plenty of prejudice in this. Obviously, the most prejudicial thing is the last issue, which we're going to get to last. This really is icing on the cake. But there's plenty of icing here.
If you have further questions, we're over time on this issue, and we'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I doubt if he needs it. I was adding him one back because I had perhaps caused confusion there. Strand.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quickly, as to the suggestion that the prosecutor knew what the answer was going to be, the trial court, in questioning Mr. Abney to clear up confusion about his testimony, had elicited his testimony that Mr. Simmons led a lifestyle of destruction. Then, following up, the prosecutor said, well, what did you know about his lifestyle of destruction?
That's an awfully open-ended question. I'm not accusing anyone of knowing what the answer is going to be, but as I say, I would have thought a defense attorney would have been on their hind legs objecting to that, wouldn't it?
And as Your Honor's question suggests, it was a difficult call once the information had come out. The fact that the objection came later, it's a difficult call for the trial judge. Do I emphasize his testimony by issuing an instruction, or do I just say, you know, let's not talk about anything that's not, you know, drug abuse?
You seem to think in your brief that it was proper to come in to begin with, which surprised me.
Well, the government's...
I don't see how the reference to the killing was proper to come in the first place. Obviously, there's a question of what to do once it's stated and what the overall effect on the trial is, but the idea that it was proper seems to me a little far-fetched.
The government's explicit theory was that Mr. Simmons acted as Mr. Franklin's runner, as the quid pro quo, as the prosecutor put it, for Mr. Franklin's taking care of him. And the
how does a prior killing?
Yeah, it's a life of. It was.
Yeah, saving you from a life of drug abuse. I understand that, but how does saving you from a killing?
Again, this is why I started by emphasizing. I don't think the prosecutor expected this answer.
I'm on to your brief's suggestion that it was fine and proper for the reference to the killing to be in.
Well, it was
how I read your brief. You have an alternative argument in the brief on the harmless error and the I understand that.
But perhaps I should move on to that. Yeah. as to pretrial notice, there was no request for a pretrial notice. Appellants have failed to show that there was a 404 request for notice. And moving on to the harmlessness, all of this information was already before the jury. Mr. Martin had testified to an admission by Simmons about killing.
I have a little bit of a question there, too. Was that to a prior killing?
Mr. Martin's testimony was that Simmons had...
in other words, this... Yeah.
That Mr. Simmons had admitted the Lurk murder.
Right. That's not a prior history of killing.
Right.
And Ms. Lee had testified not specific to that, but Ms.
Although
Lee
that
had
was the suggestion, right?
That was he said he had been involved in killing.
In other words, I don't think you get around the potential impropriety of this reference to the killing by focusing on those two witnesses. At least it's. They're two different things, a prior killing or killings and this one you're talking about here.
The jury obviously was not prejudiced by this one piece of information. As Your Honor's question suggested, they did acquit Mr. Simmons of the Lurk and Anderson violent acts, all of those violent acts. So obviously they didn't just decide this is a bad guy, he must have committed a killing. And also, importantly, there also was no possible lead over into the drug distribution counts or the conspiracy counts because the jury also found that Mr. Simmons was not involved in the cocaine distribution aspect of the crack conspiracy. So obviously they didn't just say this is a bad guy, we're going to convict him. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Good morning. I was about to call Mr. Smith again. Go ahead, Mr. Kirsch.
It's my turn now. May it please the court, Stephen Kirsch on behalf of George Wilson. And I have 5 minutes to argue. It was error to deny the motion to suppress evidence. I'll reserve 1 minute of my time for rebuttal. My argument is three-tiered. First part of the argument is that there was no probable cause for a warrant to issue, even had the warrant gone to a judge or magistrate. Second argument is that... The search warrant, yes. The second part of the argument is that the consent that was given by Nicole Harris, who was on the scene at the time of the event, was not a valid consent. She did not, in fact, voluntarily waive her right to object to the seizure. And the third part of the argument relates to Georgia versus Randolph, which was issued during the pendency of the trial, and that the record is not clear as to what the investigating officer's intent was, and that that's why the case should be remanded. I'm not arguing that Georgia versus Randolph automatically requires a reversal. I'm suggesting that Georgia versus Randolph requires a remand to complete the record, and it was error for the trial judge not to remand the matter back down for an evidentiary hearing. As to probable cause on the warrant, what the evidence shows is that on that day there were a number of warrants issued throughout this city and in Maryland related to this purported conspiracy. The warrant never made its way to a magistrate or judge because the police entered the home without the warrant, and by the investigating officer Ashby, his own words were that he did not want to wait for the warrant. He was anxious to go. He was prepared to enter that house, and he was going to sit there as long as it took for him to get the consent and for the police to be able to effectuate the search of the house. Now, what evidence was there linking George Wilson to the house? And there really was none. They did not know George Wilson's name. They knew him as Shug, and they had him on videotape. But where did they have him on videotape? At 18th and M. He was never
in his car.
That's true.
Seen at this house.
That's true. But that alone does not amount.
You said there was no evidence that linked him.
Well, I stand corrected. There was evidence that his car was at that house, but there was no evidence that that car at that house was involved in any type of criminal activity. They did also have evidence that he was using Ms. Harris's car in the area of 18th and M, but again, there was no evidence suggesting that his use of that car was illegal. And then the government emphasizes that, well, they had a telephone communication going from inside that house to Mr. Franklin's telephone, and it's completely nonspecific. We don't know who the caller was from Franklin's house. We don't know what the substance of the conversation was, and that standing alone does not amount to probable cause to effectuate arrest. It simply doesn't. Then we go to Ms. Harris, and we have to look at the totality of the circumstances to see whether or not her purported consent was in fact valid consent. What did she testify to? That the police came in, number of police came into the house, they kicked in her door, and they came up armed. That was not disputed. There was a dispute as to whether or not she was handcuffed after she was taken downstairs, and there was a photograph depicting her not in handcuffs with her arms to the sleeves of her shirt. So we would credit that testimony, as the trial court did, that when she came downstairs, she was not handcuffed. But nevertheless, she was handcuffed upstairs. She had no prior experience with the criminal justice system. She initially said, no, I'm not going to consent, then was told by Ashby, we'll sit here and wait all day long until we can go get the warrant. Then she says, okay, I'll give my consent. Submit to the court that under those circumstances, in the totality of those circumstances, that does not amount to a valid consent to search the home.
She was given the form, correct?
Yes, she was. And the form was read to her. But again, standing this woman by herself, without counsel, without experience in the criminal justice system, this clearly was coercive. And then finally, Georgia versus Randolph comes down during the pendency of this trial. And the language in Georgia versus Randolph, the key language, is that as long as there is no evidence that the police have removed the potentially objecting tenant from the entrance for the sake of avoiding a possible objection. That is where this record is completely lacking. Trial counsel made the objection. Trial counsel asked to renew the motion. And the trial court acknowledged that this is now the standard, that there's no evidence that the police engage in some sort of subterfuge to get the person out of the house.
But she said, given the state of the law at the time the officer acted.
Right. But we would be speculating to reach any conclusions as to what was in this officer's mind. We don't know. We're not holding him accountable for knowing the state of the law, but he could very well have made a decision to get Wilson out of this house as fast as he could so that he could not interpose an objection to the consent. And it was Wilson who would be much more likely to have objected to that consent than it would be Ms. Harris. And for all of those reasons, we would submit that it was error for the court to deny the motion and for not holding an evidentiary hearing to make a complete record. Thank you.
You're from the government.
excuse me, Your Honor. The trial court found that there was probable cause sufficient to support a search warrant. That was part of the basis of its inevitable discovery ruling. And that ruling was not, that factual finding was not clearly erroneous. In Detective Zapata's 78-page affidavit, He detailed that the vehicle associated with Wilson had been seen parked in front of that residence. Mr. Wilson had been seen at 18th and Place in a Chevy Lumina that was registered to Nicole Harris at that address. The car had been seen parked at the Applegarth Place address, and the pen register showed the phone calls from that house to Mr. Franklin's cell phone, which of course was his mode of doing business. That evidence obviously sufficient to support probable cause. As to the validity of the-
For a search warrant of her house?
Yes, Your Honor.
She has a boyfriend who uses her car and maybe spends the night, and they speak on the telephone.
I think it bears emphasizing that the police entered this house validly on the basis of an arrest warrant.
To arrest him. Not her.
Exactly, Your Honor. Once they entered, yeah, they found him there in her bed, sleeping with her. So at the time that they would have been applying for the search warrant, they would have added to the information that they had the fact that they had found him in her bedroom at 6 a.m.
I know, but I'm just saying, just at terms of the evidence, you've got evidence that he's at... I see you crossing your arms, so you don't want to hear this.
I would very much want to hear it. I apologize for the body language.
We won't cite your body language in the opinion.
Thank you, Your Honor. I very much appreciate that.
There were a lot of stash houses, but there wasn't any evidence that hers was a stash house, was it?
No, but the only question was whether he was associated with that residence.
Oh, I understand. He was associated, and you had evidence about that. But I just want to understand, is the government saying that if somebody has a boyfriend who spends the night, and you've got a search, an arrest warrant for the boyfriend, then you can search the girlfriend's entire house?
That's not what we're saying, Your Honor. We're saying that they validly entered under Stiegold and Payton.
That's my hypothetical. Okay. You have an arrest warrant.
Yes, they validly entered, and when they entered, they went upstairs to the master.
No question, he was there.
And he found him sleeping in her bed.
He said, and that was her fiance.
And that was sufficient to
search her house. I just want to be clear about that.
Yes, to give probable cause that he lived in that house, and that they would therefore likely find evidence of the crime in the house that he lived in.
Was there any evidence that he had been there? He was there every night.
Well, the car evidence that his car had been seen there.
He borrowed her car. I just want to be clear about what the government.
Yes,
is
that is exactly our position, Your Honor.
All right.
Once they had the information that he was found there in her bedroom at 6 a.m., they had sufficient basis to believe.
I'm surprised about the inevitable discovery argument from a different perspective, which is I had thought that it's a whole different issue to argue that we inevitably would have gotten a search warrant. That's a much broader argument than to say we're doing warrantless search tactic A, and that might have been impermissible, but we inevitably would have discovered it through warrantless search tactic B, which was permissible. When you argue inevitable discovery to say we inevitably would have gotten a warrant, you're essentially doing away with the search warrant requirement altogether, and it's way out there on a limb if we were to accept that version of the inevitable discovery argument.
That was an alternate holding of the trial court. The trial court's primary holding was that Nicole Harris voluntarily consented, and that holding was...
And on the consent theory, you don't have to get into the issues that Judge Rogers raised or that I'm raising,
exactly,
correct?
Exactly, Your Honor. And there was lots of evidence to support that finding. She was not handcuffed. She was read the form. She was explained that she did have the right to refuse consent. The trial court specifically discredited her testimony that she initially refused. She was not in any constraints.
Graduate, 33 years old?
She was substantially more educated and older than the person in Schneckloth versus Bustamante. That holding was well supported. And as to the evidentiary hearing, this claim has not been preserved. Defendant felt that an evidentiary hearing was required to look into the Georgia versus Randolph issue, They had that opportunity at the time they raised the issue before the trial court. They never asked for an evidentiary hearing. They're in no position to claim now that the trial court erred in not giving them one. And there'd be no point in sending it back anyway, because no one would have been thinking about Georgia versus Randolph 2 years before it was decided.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Give you back a minute for rebuttal. Your time was up, but you can have a minute.
In terms of whether or not this is plain error, this issue, in fact, was preserved. And the judge herself said on the record, it's in the transcript, you have preserved this issue. What happened was this case, Georgia versus Randolph, came down. There was an earlier motion to suppress that trial counsel had filed.
Right.
That hearing.
Did he ask for the hearing, I thought?
Well, in his wherefore clause of the initial motion, he requests an evidentiary hearing.
Right.
That was back in January, and they had the evidentiary hearing.
He said, I'm renewing my motion,
exactly,
but on this new ground, namely this fairly recent Supreme Court decision. And I thought the government was simply saying, while the case was cited, there was no request for a remand and a hearing.
Well, my position and the position I took in the brief is that when he renewed that motion, he renewed every part of that motion, okay, including his request for a hearing. And again, the only way to have possibly, conceivably resolved this issue as to what was in the officer's head, what was his intent, was to have held an evidentiary hearing, and it could have been done in about a half hour's time. Just get him on that witness stand, find out what he was thinking. Without that, we're lacking. And I would submit, with respect to the probable cause, the government really is seeking to just wipe out the Fourth Amendment by arguing that because George Wilson was somehow tied to his fiancée and they got into her house, that they only knew that she had possessory interest and owned that house, that entitled them to just go search the entire premises. If we allow that to happen, we have no Fourth Amendment.
We've got your argument, and your additional minute has elapsed plus some. So thank you, counsel.
And
we'll hear from Mr. Smith. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again, Judge. I'm here to argue Simmons' sentence, but I just wanted to make
Let's give him an additional minute to rebut the other argument. Put back a minute, and then we'll
This will just take 30 seconds. About the last issue, Michael Abney's testimony about the history of robbing and killing, ask yourselves this question. Since the government must have known that there was no factual basis for that testimony, why didn't they move to correct the testimony, or at least not agree that it should be stricken? They didn't do that, this wasn't the very end of the trial. There were days and days after that where that false testimony.
That sounds a lot like rebuttal. That sounds like you're re-arguing the issue. Let's move on.
All right. Well, I made the point, and I'll move on. Thank you. I think at a minimum, this court, if it doesn't reverse Simmons' conviction, and I certainly hope it will, it should at least send his case back for resentencing, because the variance sentence, the upward variance that the court imposed, really was neither substantively nor procedurally reasonable. The Simmons would appear to be a very good candidate for a downward variance, but not for an upward variance.
That's an argument for the trial judge. Under the Booker regime, we don't have much of a role in reviewing downward or upward variances, and sometimes it's going to be bad for the government, and sometimes it's going to be bad for the defendants.
I understand, Judge, but you do have some role, as the In Re Sealed Case decision shows, and I know you dissented in that case.
Well, that was about procedural reasonableness.
Right.
And now, substantive reasonableness.
Well, here we have both, actually, because
I know,
the judge made the same error.
I'm doing substantive first.
Okay.
I thought that's what you were referring
right.
to when you said he was a candidate for a downward
Absolutely.
Variance.
Absolutely. The only reason I make that point is because it suggests a need for more explanation by the judge than she provided, or more of justification for the upward variance. If someone's sentence almost cries out for a downward variance, as I think his did, of all things, for the court to oppose an upward variance, which this court well knows is a 1 in 100 proposition, especially in the District of Columbia. We never see upward variances here. Why is Mr. Simmons? Occasionally, very, very occasionally.
It's becoming more frequent because there's more. The district courts realize they're not as constrained by the guidelines.
Oh, of course, but I mean,
you're getting more variance in both directions in this court and around the country.
But I think the statistics show that upward variances are about 2% of the downward variances. So
under your view, since it's not de novo review of sentencing, and the district court tied her variance to the factors in the statute, what would this court have to find in order to hold it was unreasonable? I mean, you're saying there's no evidence against Simmons. You keep saying that, but there's a lot of evidence against him. Now, whether he deserved a variance, as Judge Kavanaugh suggested, is for the trial court to decide. So your burden here is pretty heavy, given the way the district court tied it.
Well, the court.
Statutory factors.
Well, my primary argument, at least in the opening brief, was that the court relied primarily on Simmons' drug addiction to justify the upward variance, and it's undisputed that. Under the guidelines, drug addiction is not a basis for a departure.
It's not a basis for a downward departure.
Or an upward departure.
Do the guidelines speak to that?
Yes, they do. And there's no case allowing a...
Where do the guidelines speak to you cannot use drug dependence as a factor under the statute?
Section 5H1.4.
Lead us to the relevant
part. Yeah.
Well, it...
Read us the relevant part.
Well, I don't have that provision in front of me, but it says drug or alcohol dependence or abuse is not a basis for a departure. And there is no case. I've researched this. I found no case. The government found no case in which an upward departure for or a downward departure for a drug dependence was ever upheld by an appellate court, ever.
Was there any that were reversed?
Oh, yeah. I cited a string of them.
To protection of the public.
Yeah.
That was a statutory. She tied it to a statutory factor, protection of the public.
Well, because of his drug dependence, he was a threat to the public. But just mouthing the additional words, a threat to the public, doesn't justify a departure based on drug dependence.
It wasn't a departure.
Yeah.
Well, it was a variance, right? And
that's very different.
Not the same thing.
Well, I know it's not the same thing, but again, my research and the government's showed we found no cases in which a variance had, subsequent to Booker, no case in which a variance had been justified on that ground.
Variance is going to be based on all sorts of factors related to the offense and the offender, including life history.
This is true.
And there's going to be a lot more unpredictability, and you can take into account, as you could pre-guidelines, a whole range of things in variances, correct?
I don't disagree with that, Judge.
53,
and that's going to be helpful in a lot of defendants.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I guess the question is, do you want to see a bunch of judges in this court or nationally relying on drug dependence for a downward variance and not being able to say,
It's not what I want.
I know it's not what I don't know why you'd want it in this case.
But I meant the issue is not whether I want it or don't want it.
But the ultimate
question is what our legal authority.
Right. But the ultimate question is reasonableness. Reasonableness. And I don't think it's reasonable to rely on drug dependence either for an upward or a downward departure. Or variance.
But counsel, I thought you were arguing in response to my question that it's clear from 5H1.4 that the district court could not rely on drug dependence in increasing the sentence over the guideline.
Correct.
That's not what, I'm looking at 5H1.4 and it says drug or alcohol dependence or abuse is not a reason for a downward departure.
Okay. I understand, but
I don't see anything saying that it's improper for the court to take it into account in looking at the statutory factors.
I understand. Well, that's the way all of those provisions are written. There's a whole string of them, but the courts have consistently interpreted those provisions as also banning upward.
I don't think think you have a case really on point on that.
I cited a bunch of cases in my.
I know you cited a bunch of cases. I'm saying you didn't have one that's really on point on this.
Hold on there, Judge.
Big bunch.
That says exactly what you said.
Well, let's see. You know something? My parentheticals don't indicate whether these are upward or downward departures. Neither I nor the government found a case where an upward depart either. The upward departures just didn't occur, period, which is significant in itself. Or if they did occur, they were reversed. We found none upholding one.
Didn't the trial judge tie this, a la 3553, to the danger to the public, as Judge Rogers
said? Well, come on. I mean, Mr. Simmons, if you ignore the fact that he was accused of a murder, let's put that aside since he was acquitted. Mr. Simmons hardly seems to be more of a danger to the public than your average defendant in the District of Columbia. He seems far less so.
5H1.4 in its rationale say that substance abuse is highly correlated to an increased propensity to commit crime. That's language from 5H1.4. That's the guideline you're relying on.
I know, but
I don't know who your average defendant in the District of Columbia is. I mean, talking about people who are petty larcenists as opposed to what Mr. Simmons is alleged to have been.
I mean, the only thing Mr. Simmons has ever been convicted of is drugs, you know, and a very minor role at that in the drug offense. And of course, he's admitted to stealing from his own family to support his drug addiction. But, you know, I hardly think that warrants an upward variance above 235 months. I mean, for Pete's sake, isn't 235 months a severe enough sentence?
Well, that's what the district judge had to decide. You're asking the wrong people if that's a severe enough sentence.
I think, if anything, upward variances should be scrutinized more carefully than downward variances.
Is there any precedent for that?
I don't know. That's the honest answer.
I don't think so.
But
it's a fair argument, but I don't think there's precedent.
But as there may not be precedent actually saying that, Judge, but as you know from your deep knowledge of these cases, the fact is courts do scrutinize upward variances and they scrutinized upward departures much more carefully. Because they're not favored. I mean, whether or not that's the law or not, most courts do look at these upward departures and variances a lot closer than the downward ones.
Your argument is sort of like, you know, there are no principles to guide us. And that can't be an argument that we can accept, much less even think it's correct.
Well, I think I'd better use the rest of my time to talk about the procedural point because I don't seem to be.
Your time is gone.
It's gone.
A couple more minutes.
Well, the procedural point is a plain error point, and this court just decided in Raid Seal case. Judge Kavanaugh was on the panel, and I wish I had had his vote, but I didn't. But I respect, you know, he wrote an excellent dissent. But nonetheless, that's the law in this court, as it is in the Second Circuit.
When you say that's the law, you mean a written statement of reasons?
Yes, there must be a written statement of reasons.
There is some written statement of reasons in the record here, correct?
No, there's none whatsoever.
Isn't there one under seal?
No. I submitted the amended J&C. It's blank on the statement of reasons. Blank.
I think there's one under seal.
If there is, I've never seen it, and I don't.
I may not have seen it, but I believe there is one under seal.
There is?
Where it has the judge's handwriting on it?
Yeah, one that has the judge's handwriting on
it. Have you seen this one?
Certainly think so.
What is it?
I'm confusing this with. I see nods from my colleagues and from the prosecution that it exists. There may have been some lapse in the information that defense attorney has been provided, but
I've got the amended J&C. One would think that would go to the defense counsel.
I would have thought you would have had access to the under seal.
If there is one, I'd like to see it and
there's been a lot of paper in this case, and I'm not faulting anybody for whatever lapse has occurred, but I think we're all.
This was an issue you raised only in the reply brief, too, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct.
We may not bother doing anything with it since it came in the reply brief, but I think maybe that's why you never got the information. You didn't prompt it at the right time.
Well, Well, at any rate, it has not been brought to my attention previously, so I'd like to see it if it exists, and you know, to see what it says. But I do think that the judge, I don't know why that was placed under seal anyhow. I don't see any reason to seal it. We didn't, the defense didn't ask that it be sealed. You know, that puts me in an awkward position, but
I understand that. And you raised it at the late date.
I understand. I understand. I should have raised it earlier, but it is a point.
We don't normally pay much attention to arguments raised in reply briefs.
I understand. Well,
we've said that officially. That's not a surprise.
I understand. But I really do think that the sentence should be far lower.
Well, I think your time is up on this.
And my time is up.
Unless my colleagues have further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope the sentencing issue is moot because his conviction will be reversed. Thank you.
Hope springs eternal.
I hope.
Hear from the government.
I've got the document here. There was, in fact, the statement of reasons set portion of it was filed under seal consistent with the court's judicial policy. And there is the judge's handwriting that not only said that the narcotics and RICO conspiracy of insufficient foreseeability was more than the 1 to 3 kilos found for the offense of conviction, but also the note, see sentencing transcript. And the sentencing transcript provided very detailed explanation for why the trial court did the upward variance that it did. Obviously,
we have a policy that judgments are automatically sealed in criminal cases. That's a question.
The statement of reasons generally are filed under seal.
And that's our policy? That's what
I believe
said.
That's the district court's policy.
Right? District court's policy. All right. Just I didn't know about any policy that we had.
It's new to me, too. And that's not to say I'm faulting it, but
no.
It's new to me. Excuse me. Go ahead.
So no procedural.
So defense counsel have not seen this. Is that correct? No, I mean, if the district court puts it under seal.
I think probably the defense counsel has seen it because the prosecutor's office got a full copy.
Whatever happened here, I'm willing to believe counsel's right. statement that he has not seen it. We have no reason to believe he's other than an honorable right.
and I didn't mean
officer
to
of the court.
I did not mean to suggest that.
Generally, the defense attorney would have seen it, but for whatever reason in this case, perhaps because of the volume of paper and the fact of the amendment, it never got to the defense attorney, apparently. Excuse me, go ahead.
And different defense attorney and appellate attorney.
This is true, too. Yep. There was a different counsel. He came in at the appellate phase.
So in
I just be clear, if I were a defense attorney representing a defendant and under the district court's policy that the judgment and the judge's reasons are sealed, do you know whether defense counsel would be denied access to that document?
Oh, no, I don't think so, Your Honor.
All right.
I think it's just copied to counsel, but what's put on the ECF, on the public
right.
record,
right.
the statement of reasons is not included there. Obviously, this is not in Ray's sealed case because here there was both a written and an oral explanation of the reasons, so this court is not prevented from reviewing the substantive reasonableness. The trial court gave implacable drug dependence as one of several grounds for the upward variance. Others were the seriousness of the offense, the need to provide just punishment and adequate general deterrence, and the need to protect the public from further crimes by Mr. Simmons.
Do you know how she came up with 29 months?
22 years?
No, 29 months. That's the bump. In other words, it was 235 months, and now it's 264 months. And isn't the difference 29 months? And I just wondered, how'd she come up with
19 months?
How'd she come up with 19 months?
Well, she felt that 22 years.
I thought it was 29, but at any rate.
Is it 29? My math.
Whatever it is, how did she come up with that number?
Whatever it is, yes, she had 264 months is 22 years. And she felt that 22 years was appropriate sentence given the factors, the 3553A factors.
Well, I know she said she didn't think 235 was enough.
And she said she did also say that she thought 22 years was the appropriate sentence given the 3553A factors.
Okay.
And as to the, of course, the defense counsel did not object below to the trial court's reliance on the drug dependence. In fact, the defense counsel, Mr. Purpura, specifically told the court that he was satisfied and she had answered all his objections. So any error here, any review here is for plain error. Obviously, there's no plain error where there's no, as in Melvin Brown, no clear rule one way or the other. And all of the authority that there is suggests that it is appropriate to rely on drug dependence for even for an upward departure.
The district court had given 10 years instead of 22 years. That would have been fine also, right?
Yes.
From our perspective, the appellate court.
You may not have liked it, but right. Wouldn't yeah. be much we could do about it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or should do about it. Okay, thank you, counsel. I guess we should probably have a minute for rebuttal on this. I've lost track of exactly. Do you want one?
I think you've heard my argument.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Good. Thank you. Now we'll hear from the next. Find my list again.
This is talking about sentencing issues, quantity, and managerial role, focusing primarily on Mr. Blackson. If you will indulge me, I'd like to reserve 1 minute. If I might just respond to Judge Rogers' the last argument. What happens, Your Honor?
Last question.
Yes. With respect to the pre-sentence reports, I'm sorry, not the pre-sentence reports, the judgment of commitments, the sealed portion, the statement of reasons, is usually mailed to defense counsel. It is not available on the ECF if you pull it up. And as a consequence, if that piece of paper doesn't make it to or from the trial defense counsel, the appellate counsel generally has no way of short of asking the court to unseal it. At any rate, let me make, if I might, one general comment as respects to the number of other defendants made these similar arguments about quantity. We believe that this organization at 18th and M is different than some of the narcotics conspiracies that this court has dealt with that are extremely structured. It would be our view that this was, while it may have indeed been an association, and I'm not commenting on the RICO issues, it was basically unstructured, and I think that's underlies the arguments of almost all of the other counsels besides Mr. Franklin. With respect to the amounts, With respect to the amounts that the judge used, she used the testimony of Herbert Martin to calculate them, and Herbert Martin certainly provided an enormous quantity of drugs to John Franklin and then on down. The problem is, of course, that nobody tried to make any determination as to, well, on this date, this amount was given. And when Martin testified at trial, he testified that there would be periods when there would be a drought, and then there would be periods in which he had lots of PCP. His good run was in August and then the early fall, and that's when Mr. Blackson was in jail. And so when we talk about the need for specific findings, the judge made those findings, all right? It's not a procedural issue. But the findings that she made was really that Mr. Blackson would have known that the sales would have continued because he hadn't withdrawn from the conspiracy, that he had his conversation on the phone.
That there was no withdrawal by him from the
conspiracy. Right, that's what I said, that he had not withdrawn. But the problem that we view it is it's really, okay, it is probably fair to assume that Mr. Blackson could have assumed, absent the arrest of John Franklin, that the sales would continue. The question becomes, how would he have known the quantity? He would have known there was some. That's why I suggested that remand was the remedy and not, as the government, they'll talk about whether they think the proper remedy is if you find there was error. But that's why I suggested that he can't sit there and say, okay, Martin said I delivered all of this PCP. Some of it only went to Franklin after Blackson was in jail. How would Blackson know how much it was? That there may have been some, yes. How much, no. And without the specific findings as to when, I suggest that they have not met their threshold
let
with respect.
Be clear. He's in it from the start. He's in it at the end. He's in jail for 6 months in the middle.
Correct.
And this is just a foreseeability issue.
Yes, yes. We did not argue that Blackson had withdrawn from the conspiracy. Yeah. What we had argued was that, look, the quantities go up while he's in jail. And while he's curious about what's happening out there, while he might indeed infer that his brother was continuing his organization, how would he know that the quantities had gone up? In other words, that's why we think that the findings were deficient. With respect to the managerial role, I think the Smith case makes it very clear that you have to show that somebody controlled someone else, and there is no evidence in the record that Blackson did that. There is some testimony by Leftridge that Blackson claimed that he and Franklin were supplying the neighborhood. That does not, in fact, appear to be the case. I would direct your attention to the transcript at the government's appendix 206 to 211, where Blackson doesn't have any drugs, is taking her to someone else and says, I cannot control what they're going to sell it to you for. There is the issue about Michael Abney saying that he was a lieutenant, and I think this court has recognized that terminology is not dispositive. You have to look at the actual evidence. And there is no evidence in this case that anybody was accountable to Joseph Blackson.
Counsel, we'll hear from the government.
There was no clear error in the trial court's factual finding that it was reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Blackson that the conspiracy would involve the sale of more than 30 kilograms of PCP. As Judge Rogers's question suggests, there was plenary evidence that Mr. Blackson was involved from the beginning. He, in fact, was the one who put Mr. Franklin in touch with Mr. Abney when they wanted to, quote, bring water to 18th and M Street. That is how it got started there. He was known in the organization to be a lieutenant. It was not conclusory testimony that he was a lieutenant. Mr. Abney specifically.
Is there anything more than Abney's testimony on that?
There is, Your Honor.
On the fact that he was a lieutenant?
Yes, Your Honor. There were two other defendants, Tucker and Minnis, I believe, who testified that Mr. Blackson was one of the three people who, quote, held water for Mr. Franklin when Mr. Franklin was not around. That was one of the roles of the lieutenant, was to act in Mr. Franklin's stead when he was not around. And not only that, but Mr. Abney testified that Mr. Blackson gave advice to other crew members, helped keep the money spot cool. So there was very specific testimony about his role as a lieutenant. It was not conclusory. He did not withdraw from the conspiracy when he, as the trial court found, when he was in prison. In fact, the evidence was that he continued to, he arranged three-way telephone calls through his girlfriend Diamond White with Mr. Franklin, not only to keep tabs on what was happening on M Street, which crew members had been arrested, which ones were in jail, but also to arrange for drugs to be delivered to him in prison so that he could continue the conspiracy there, setting up a satellite office.
Location is everything.
For all those reasons, the trial court's finding as to amounts was not clear error.
So you're saying that evidence that he held was enough to show that he controlled others? He held the money, he held...
Well, the control element here comes from his authority as a lieutenant to resolve disputes. He was one of the people that crew members went to resolve disputes,
so
who
to
took
Abney.
Advice.
Yes, Abney's the only one who says anything about that.
Abney is the one who specifies that, but several others also termed him a lieutenant. And yes, Mr. Franklin's role, Mr. Franklin himself, his primary role was to supply water in distribution quantities to the...
No, I'm on Blackson.
I understand that. But if that was what made Mr. Franklin the leader of the organization, for Mr. Blackson to take that role when Mr. Franklin was away...
That's the question. Did he take that role, or did he only hold money? I mean,
hold water.
Banker, and you say he holds some of the drugs as distinct from controlling somebody else the way there was evidence as to Wilson and Robinson. That's what I'm getting at. I mean, there may be evidence, but I'm just looking at what the district court relied on.
The evidence was similar as to both Mr. Blackson and Mr. Robinson.
But I don't think it is. That's what I'm getting at. You've cited Tucker and Minnis for the fact that he was holding water.
Yes.
That doesn't tell me he's controlling anybody. And then he held money.
If I could, we had a number of
advice is different as opposed to the other evidence where on the audio you had, you know, Franklin giving directions to Wilson to do something, that sort of thing. You just don't have that here. At least I haven't found it, and I looked in your brief, obviously.
Having a status in the organization where subordinates report to you.
Where is that testimony?
No, they went to him for advice.
Where is the testimony about
that? That's all I'm getting.
That's Michael Abney. Michael Abney.
Abney is alone on that, right? I'm not asking you to give up very much. If
Abney is alone,
you would say Abney is still sufficient.
Abney is sufficient.
Abney's definition of a lieutenant didn't have anything to do with control. That's what I'm trying to pin down here.
Abney's definition of lieutenant
says they made more money.
I'm sorry.
They made more money. You know,
that
I mean,
that.
Abney backed off as when the. There was cross-examination as to what he meant when he said lieutenant. That's all I'm getting at.
I would not agree with that characterization.
It's not a characterization. It's his own testimony.
I believe his testimony, Your Honor, was that the lieutenants made sure that 18th and M Street ran the way the big man would want it run when he was away. He did not back off that testimony. And, yes, if crew members know that they have to go to the lieutenant to resolve issues. That is...
No, giving advice is not the same as knowing that you have to go to somebody to get advice. That's all I'm getting at.
Abney's testimony was sufficient to satisfy the clear error standard as to the trial court's factual finding. As to the manager or supervisor enhancement under 3B1.1b, there was no error. According to the due deference that this court has held, is the trial court is entitled to.
I may have confused you, and I apologize if I did. I was talking about the role, the enhancement for his managerial role. I was not talking about foreseeability.
I was confused about that, Your Honor.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's a confusing case sometimes. They just don't organize clearly enough. If you could flash the word out on the streets.
The evidence that the court relied on for that determination was that Blackson was the person with whom Officer Lethbridge made her initial connections. His conduct and position on M Street was such that investigating law enforcement officers initially thought he was the leader of the crew. He told Blackson himself on March 26, 2003
Make it quick.
That he and his brother supplied everyone. I think I have addressed already Judge Rogers' question.
Unless my colleagues have questions, your time is over now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll give back a minute for rebuttal.
You're absolutely right, Judge Rogers. I had the honor of being a lieutenant in the United States Army when I was much younger, and I didn't give advice. I gave orders. And there's no indication that Blackson did anything of that nature.
Advice might have been considered fraternizing, but it's depending on what it was about. I think that concludes the unsealed portion of the argument. We will retire for a brief recess while the people in the courtroom reorganize themselves. Those that are not supposed to be present for the sealed portion can leave, and those who can be present can stay if they want to, except for the attorneys, they're not required to. Give us a brief recess.